Christ Your Life, an Easter sermon preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin.
Even though we die, we live. When a Christian breathes his last, no one dies. No one can die. For Christ has already died in the Christian's place.
And we'll send you a CD of this sermon and an Ascension sermon for any size gift before Easter Sunday. Make a secure online donation today. IssueZTC.org. Thanks for your support during the season of Lent.
Our thoughts and our prayers are with the people of Japan. This is a potentially catastrophic disaster.
Al-Qaeda is actively targeting the American Muslim community for recruitment. Today's hearing will address this dangerous trend.
It's true that specific individuals, including some who are Muslims, are violent extremists. However, these are individuals, not entire communities.
God does not need anything from us. And when we worship, we're receiving things from Him. God is the giver, and we are on the receiving end of His gift. That's what it means to be a Christian.
Kansas Lutheran truck drivers are no strangers to multitasking. We can both listen to issues, etc., and pronounce it correctly at the same time.
He has become the butt of jokes. He is a stock character in comedy, sometimes a bit pathetic, whether it's teen party movies or sitcoms. He is the guy who hasn't yet grown up, but he should have about 10 years earlier. Is he an emerging adult? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. on this Thursday afternoon, March the 24th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We'll be talking with Colleen Carol Campbell about perpetual adolescence a little bit later, the story of baby Joseph and the rationing of health care. Right after that, Greg Kokel joins us on this Thursday afternoon to talk about the sexual ethic, try before you buy, and to respond to it. Joining us to talk about perpetual adolescence, Colleen Carol Campbell. She's a regular guest. She's host of a radio and television program, Faith and Culture, author of the book, The New Faithful, and she writes a weekly column for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Colleen, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
It is. I know what an adolescent is. I got one at home. And I know what an adult is. I most days pretend to be one myself. What is an emerging adult?
Well, this is a new category. It was defined in 2004 by a psychologist by the name of Jeffrey Jensen Arnett. And he postulated that the 20s have really become, for most young Americans, sort of an extended part of their adolescence. He would say it's not technically adolescence, but it's definitely not adulthood yet. They're basically post-adolescents who have adult freedoms but not the adult responsibilities. He said this is a whole new category and we need to start thinking about it that way and talking about it that way. And he invented this term, emerging adulthood, which was picked up then by the New York Times and various other journalists and pundits and is now thrown around pretty frequently to describe young Americans between roughly the ages of 18 to 25 to 30. It sort of depends on who you're talking to. And basically, the idea behind this is the fact that in 1970, the typical 21-year-old was already married with children or about ready to get married and have children, had already finished his education and was established in a job or as a full-time mother. Whereas today, the typical 21-year-old is still in the middle of his education, still sort of job-hopping, trying to figure out what he wants to do with his life, and generally, usually has no near-term plans for marriage or parenthood. So there's a real difference here, and that's what is now the expectation. We generally don't expect to meet a 23-year-old who's married. We generally expect them to be finding themselves for the next decade. And so it's a new term. It's a new phase, some would argue. Others say, well, I'm not so sure it's new. It might simply be an extension of adolescence and one that isn't altogether appropriate.
But let's be honest here. We're really talking mostly about men or boy men or whatever you want to call them, right?
Right. I mean, I think this certainly applies to young women in the sense that many of them, too, are very focused on their careers in their 20s. And as much as they might be interested in marriage and motherhood, they have this sense that they often get from the culture and their own parents that they shouldn't even be thinking about such things until they hit 30, at which point sometimes they find it's not so easy to just go off and get married and have kids as they maybe thought it would be, judging from Sex and the City and all the other shows they watch. But yes, on the whole, at least where the problem films come in, most of the talk has been centering on young men. Kay Heimowitz is a conservative author and sort of a social analyst. She recently came out with a book that's been getting a lot of attention called Manning Up. And in it, she describes what she calls child men, those 20-something guys who play video games and guzzle beer and swap gross-out jokes with their friends, while the women that they are dating, or maybe not even technically dating, but sort of having hookups with, are climbing the career ladder. And so there's this disconnect between these kind of child men who are basically reveling in their teenage fantasies and living those fantasies out until sometimes well into their 30s, and the ambitious women in their lives who are often frustrated that they can't get their boyfriends to commit to something, or they can't even get men to commit to being boyfriends. And I think this is part of what's probably driving down marriage rates among the young, among other things, this sense that a lot of young men don't quite know what's expected of them when they become men. And so in a sense, they don't ever become men, or at least not until their 30s in any serious way in terms of the choices they make.
I don't know if we can answer this question, but I got to ask why. I mean, how is it that we've gotten in a relatively short amount of time? I know culturally 50, 60 years in America is might as well be 1,000 years, but how have we gotten from a guy who knew that not only was it the expectation, but it was actually an adult thing to do, to get a full-time job or to get out of school and start a career and get going with this marriage and family and all of those things, to guys still living with mom and dad when he's 27 years old? And he may have a part-time job. He might have a college degree. Maybe he doesn't. And if you ask him what he's going to do with his life, he just kind of shrugs his shoulders and goes back to drinking Mountain Dew on the couch.
Right. Well, I think there are a lot of reasons for this. And it is probably too much to sum up in just a short conversation. I mean, the sexual revolution certainly has played into this. It was supposed to liberate women. And the problem, I think, is that in many ways it just liberated men to sort of act like randy teenagers all through their 20s rather than having to sort of shape up and find a wife, because women weren't going to put up with them for 10 years just dithering around trying to figure out what they wanted to do with themselves and if they were ready to accept the responsibilities of marriage and parenthood. So I think the sexual revolution had a lot to do with it and changing expectations of women that women had for men. But Kay Heimowitz argues, interestingly, that part of it is linked to our cultural uncertainty about men. That's what she calls it. And she just talks about how nearly every civilization, boys had to pass a certain kind of test in order to be considered men. Women basically just had to go through puberty and they were assumed to be women. But for men, there was sort of a cultural test or a challenge. And in our culture, at least in modern times, that's generally been marriage and parenthood. And now that that's been taken away, along with it, there's also been, I think, a denigration of what we used to consider manly virtues. They're not exclusive to men, of course, but the virtues of, you know, fortitude and courage and stoicism and fidelity. Nowadays, if a man has those virtues and openly embraces them, you know, he might find himself chided or sort of looked askance upon as if he's not really a liberated man, that he's a little too a little too old-fashioned or traditional. And the same might go if he actually does expect to find a wife at a fairly early age, say in his early 20s, what used to be considered a very normal age for marriage. So some of this is the societal messages that men are getting, the sense that we don't expect them to grow up. We don't expect them to take responsibility. And in fact, if they want to be strong protectors and providers for their families, we might even find that slightly menacing. If you can judge, for instance, by the kind of reaction the Promise Keepers group got in the 90s and into the 2000s, when they were encouraging men to do just that. And feminists were sort of flipping out, saying, you know, this is patriarchy rearing its ugly head again. So I think in a lot of ways, men don't quite know what we expect of them. Women don't quite know what to ask of men. And as a result, we have the child men living in their mother's basements. And I think it's a real problem.
One quick question on that. What do the statistics show about where this has led us and where this will lead likely in the future, especially when it comes to marriage rates, when it comes to future divorce, when it comes to out-of-wedlock children, things like that?
Well, already we're seeing that the marriage rate in the United States, marriage rates are dropping pretty precipitously. Among young adults, the average age of first marriage, it keeps rising and rising. We're finding that growing numbers of children are being born out of wedlock. I think the number is 4 out of every 10 today. And that's quite a change even from 1970 or 1980. So there's a real spike in single motherhood. I think, again, you often have the case of women who are pursuing their education, pursuing their career options, looking around and not finding too many choices when it comes to men who are equally ambitious. Now, this is not obviously the case with everyone. We all know plenty of ambitious, dedicated, you know, serious young men. But on the whole, it is creating this cultural phenomenon where, you know, we've heard a lot about the he session, the recent recession where it was men who lost 3/4 of the jobs. College campuses, men are increasingly very much in the minority on some campuses. And so it creates all sort of strange dynamics, including what the sociologist who recently wrote a book, Premarital Sex in America, described as a skewed sexual marketplace in which young men, often not terribly accomplished young men, sort of hold all the cards in this hookup culture that's been created where they can basically, you know, fulfill their sexual whims without really trading any sort of commitment to the women in their lives in exchange for that. And women kind of put up with that because that's the new normal. And that's what it means to be liberated in this day and age. And I think a lot of young women look up at age, you know, 29 or 30 and say, I'm not sure how liberated I am, you know. And I think that's even the case, you could argue, for men, you know, that all this sort of dithering around, as much fun as it seems like, at a certain point becomes also very empty, even for the young men who are engaged in it and who are distracted by just sort of the pursuit of one rather adolescent pleasure to another, from actually pursuing excellence in both their professional and personal lives. So we don't quite know what the full consequences are, but I think we can say that this whole new phase of emerging adulthood certainly has some costs that we need to be very wary about, especially when we see our children walking down this path, as many parents do today, looking at their 20-somethings who seem rather aimless.
Well, when we come back, I got one more topic to discuss with Colleen Carroll Campbell, Baby Joseph and the realities of healthcare rationing. That's right after this.
These days, value affords me a new attitude. It lets me appreciate that I can start my day with more than a $6 cup of coffee, and that I officially have permission to skip dinner out to spend time talking with my family over Casserole Inn. Concordia Publishing House offers Christian products that help me focus on what matters most. Visit any of the 3 Concordia bookstores downtown in Kirkwood and on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton, or shop online at cph.org and find out what a new value attitude looks like in your life.
Christ Your Life, an Easter sermon preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin.
Even though we die, we live. When a Christian breathes his last, no one dies. No one can die. For Christ has already died in the Christian's place.
And we'll send you a CD of this sermon and an Ascension sermon for any size gift before Easter Sunday. Make a secure online donation today. IssuesETC.org. Thanks for your support during the season of Lent.
Treadmill for the Mind. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Steadfast Lutherans. People who believe the law condemns everyone and should be preached to the fullest. People who believe the gospel is for everyone and should be preached to its sweetest. Traditional Lutheran doctrine and practice deliver every Sunday this law and gospel, that Christ was crucified for us sinners. To all who received him, who believed in his name, the Gospel of John says, he gave the right to become children of God. To see how Steadfast Lutherans preserves this good news for everyone, visit steadfastlutherans.org.
Did you know that you can listen to Issues Etc. 24/7? Check out our website, IssuesETC.org, and go to the Listen On Demand page. Listen at the gym, in your kitchen, in your garden, on your iPod, your computer, or in your car. The technology may be new, but the truth never changes. Issues Etc. On Demand audio, available for your convenience at IssuesETC.org. 10 hours of new programming each week. IssuesETC.org, and click Listen On Demand.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Colleen Carroll Campbell is our guest. We're moving on to the subject of Baby Joseph and healthcare. Colin, you've written recently about this. Who is Baby Joseph? What's his story? And how does it show us the realities of healthcare rationing?
Well, Baby Joseph is a 13-month-old infant who recently was airlifted to Cardinal Glennon Hospital here in St. Louis, Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital, Catholic Hospital here in St. Louis. He came from Canada where his parents had been engaged in a fight since last October to have a tracheotomy performed on him. That's a common medical procedure. It basically entails inserting a small tube directly into a patient's windpipe so he can breathe more easily and avoid the less comfortable breathing tube, which has to go down through your nose and down your or through your mouth. Tracheotomy, you know, requires some light anesthesia, minimal discomfort, and often allows patients to speak, eat, or drink normally. The problem with Baby Joseph is that he's been diagnosed with a severe neurological disorder. It's all but certain that he's going to die. His older sister, Zena, had the same disorder, and she too died. But her parents in Canada had an opportunity to have this tracheotomy done on Zena, and that allowed them to take her home and have her live at home with them for 6 more months before this little baby died. Now, their son's diagnosed with the same problem. They wanted the same thing for their son, but Canada's national health care system, where the government really calls the final shots for you in terms of your choices, the doctors there said no to this pretty reasonable request of the parents. They appealed to a government-run health care panel. The panel said no, and they couldn't find anyone to do this for them because the Canadian courts rejected their appeal on this. So after much calling around and with the help of the Priests for Life pro-life group here in the United States, they found a hospital, Cardinal Glennon in St. Louis, willing to do this tracheotomy. The reason this case is important is because what Canada's healthcare system looks like today, which leaves, unfortunately, parents like those of Baby Joseph with too few choices when they're asking for something reasonable that doctors don't consider either medically necessary or worth the cost. What that looks like today may be what our system looks like tomorrow, thanks to Obamacare. And there are a lot of reasons to believe we have some similar rationing in store for us in the future.
Right now, we do have those safeguards. I mean, it's one of the reasons why little baby Joseph could get the care here readily, just because the hospital said, okay, we'll do it, as opposed to running it through a series of courts and other decision-making bodies. Those safeguards exist today. From what you know of President Obama's health care reforms, are those safeguards going away or not?
Well, we don't know for sure, but we have reason to believe they very well may go. I mean, one reason that this was able to be done in the United States is the parents found this organization, a nonprofit group, willing to raise money so this common medical procedure could be conducted. And if you can find money to pay for something that's ethical and medically reasonable, in the United States, generally, you can get it done. Not so in Canada. With Obamacare, if it's implemented in its current form, we may lose some of those safeguards, and the reason is because the law is going to bring about a great deal of consolidation in healthcare. It's going to leave fewer insurers and fewer hospital systems and sort of put them all under the thumb of public cost control imperatives. And Obama has promised this, that his system will save taxpayers money by eliminating what he calls cost-ineffective procedures. Now, that inevitably takes decisions away from care, about care from doctors and patients. We know that's just generally been the pattern in any country where this sort of system has been adopted. And those who've been describing, you know, death panels and fears about rationing have been made fun of for being alarmists, but it may actually be that the new Independent Payment Advisory Board, this is the name of a board created by the recent health care reform law, I mean, that board is going to have the power to deny Medicare payments for services deemed not cost-effective. And those decisions, while they only apply to Medicare, they're going to have repercussions throughout the healthcare sector because those kind of decisions have a way of shaping other hospitals' decisions and other doctors' decisions. So, yes, I think we have a real reason to fear that this kind of rationing could be coming to the United States with the greater power that's being handed over to the government and the power that doctors and patients are losing.
And finally, with only a minute here, it's not like it can't get worse. We do see in Northern Europe some indications of where this can go in its extreme, don't we?
Absolutely. I mean, we've all heard stories from Britain, the so-called NICE panel, it's an acronym and not a very apt one, that routinely denies British patients procedures that they would be able to get in the United States, but they're considered not worth the cost over there. In the Netherlands, it's gotten even worse. Child euthanasia is legal there, not just adult euthanasia now, but child euthanasia. It's regulated by a protocol created by doctors which cites such subjective measures as hopeless and unbearable suffering as a reason for both parents and physicians to go ahead and put sick infants to death. So they are literally euthanizing children legally in the Netherlands because by looking at them, they say, this child is not imminently dying. We could save his life or at least prolong his life, but he's severely ill and we judge his quality of life to be so poor as to not be worth extending. And that's a big leap from saying, here, this person's going to die in the next 24 hours. We're going to take the tubes out and let him die in peace. That's a huge leap, and it's already been made in Europe, and it may be on its way here to the United States. In fact, we've already seen cases like the Schiavo case where quality of life was sort of the deciding factor, that someone who could have continued to live with basic food and water was denied those things because it was perceived that her quality of life was too low to make her life worth extending.
Colleen Carroll Campbell is host of a radio and television program called Faith and Culture. She's author of the book, The New Faithful, and she writes a weekly column for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Check out her columns under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. Thanks, Colleen.
Thanks for having me, Todd.